This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hello and welcome to The Tonight Show. Less than 3% of rental properties available through the government's housing assistance payment scheme. We ask if it's time to scrap HAP. Late last orders, we debate if increased opening hours for our bars will have a detrimental impact on our roads. And 170,000 public sector workers take to the picket lines in one of the biggest strikes in the history of Northern Ireland.
So that's day and daily. Patients aren't safe. But if we don't stand up, as our code of conduct tells us to, and fight for fair pay and safe staffing, then they will never be safe.
Report from the Simon Communities of Ireland has found that there were no properties available to rent under the Housing Assistance Payment or HAP scheme in 9 out of 16 areas that they looked at across the country. Our panel tonight is Green Party Senator Pauline O'Reilly, Social Democrats TD Jennifer Whitmore, Craig Hughes, political correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail, and Executive Director of Simon Communities of Ireland, Wayne Stanley. And joining us down the line tonight is Barra Rowntree, Assistant Professor of Economics at Trinity College Dublin. But first to the news that a man has been killed following an explosion at a homeless hostel operated by DePaul Ireland on Little Britain Street in Dublin city centre earlier this afternoon. Gardaí are investigating the cause of the blast at the shelter, which was contained to one room. Well, Wayne Stanley, just to get your reaction to this, it must be a shock for what is a pretty tight community. And there were obviously a number of homeless service users around at the time when this tragedy struck.
Yeah, so I think from the Simon Communities, we'd like to extend our condolences to the service users' family and friends, to the wider community who were in the service, and also I'd like to make a particular mention for the staff who will obviously have known the service user. Obviously, we don't have any details at the moment as Gardaí are continuing to investigate.
Yeah, the precise cause of the blast still under investigation tonight. People were evacuated from the building on Little Britain Street. They can't obviously remain there tonight. How has that impacted on homeless accommodation in the city centre?
So my understanding is that they're working with the DRHE, the Dublin Regional Homeless Executive, and other NGOs to find accommodation for the other service users who would have been in that service. I'm sure places will be found for everyone. It obviously will put additional pressure on the system. We know it's going to be very cold in Dublin tonight, and extra beds had been opened, emergency beds for the cold weather strategy. So that extra capacity, some of that will be taken up, but I'm sure beds will be found for everyone.
All right, OK. We want to move on to the story that we brought you in here tonight to talk about, Wayne, because it's your report looking at this housing assistance payment, something that many people rely on in order to get a roof over their heads. You have looked at the national picture and rentals available under that scheme, and they're in chronically short supply, aren't they? You know, there's no properties to rent in 9 out of 16 areas that you looked at, as you stated. Has it worsened dramatically recently? Because this is a quarterly report. So are you seeing a growing trend here?
So certainly the last 2 years, there's been a chronic shortage over all that time. Really, over last year, the average percentage of properties available under a housing assistance payment has been around 4%. This last one, which was still 2023, was down to 3%. But if you go back to 2021, there was still a shortage of supply. We all know it's a very tight private rental market, but at least with a housing assistance payment, if the local authority was using the maximum discretion available to them, there would be about 27% of the properties would have been available to somebody on a housing assistance payment. The reason why the Simon Communities look at this particular area is a number of years ago, quite recently, the private rental market would have been one of the major routes out of homelessness for people. Maybe 60% of people moving on from homelessness would have been into the private rental market. That has now fallen off a cliff. Many local authorities are starting to step up and allocate increased numbers of properties to try and bridge that gap, but they're not able to bridge it. Or what they're doing isn't enough to bridge it. And so what we're seeing is the increasing homeless figures that we continue to see month on month.
OK, so you think that it directly correlates then with the increasing homeless figures, as you say, that we've been seeing a record number of homeless?
Yeah, well, what we've known is the private rental market and people losing their home in the private rental market is a big driver of homelessness, in particular family homelessness. This year, we had during Simon Week, we had our conference. We had a speaker who came from the US, and he looked at all 50 states. And their experience is very similar to what we've seen here, which is if you look at a state, regardless of how wealthy it is, regardless of how levels of mental health, family breakup, all those kind of social issues that we sometimes apportion to as a reason for homelessness, if there's a shortage of secure, affordable accommodation, you see more homelessness. If there's secure, affordable accommodation, you see less. Okay. That's the universal truth.
All right. Paulina Riley, to bring you in on this, it's a basic tenet, isn't it? To have a roof over your head, for it to be secure, for it to be stable. This study would appear to bear out that that is not the case. If there are no properties available under the very scheme that the government has in place to ensure that people who do need that extra support to avail of rental accommodation, they just simply can't get it.
Look, I mean, everybody recognises the challenges when it comes to housing, and the ultimate answer is supply, supply, supply. That's what we need to drive up. And I think that just on the pure figures in terms of how many houses have been delivered, that's 100,000 over the term of government, which is more than the previous two governments combined. So year on year, that's
you're
that's
talking
increased.
About housing supply
I,
now.
I am, but
can,
but they
can
are
we just
all
go back? Because what's needed now, in immediate term, is a greater supply of HAP available properties. So what's happening?
I think it's really important to say here that HAP is not a perfect system, precisely for the reasons outlined. An over reliance on private landlords to support what should be a social housing issue. That's not the route that we envisage, and that's
but
why.
That's, but I mean, well, it's not just what we envisage, but it's what's there.
But just to respond to that, that's why there are more social homes being built now than since 1975. Right now, we are in a boom when it comes to social housing. So half of those commencements are social housing, and that is the route out of HAP. So I mean, I listened to the Minister for Housing this evening, and what he's saying is that there are 160 new HAP tenancies every week. So that is continuing. Now, that's not to say that any of these things are ideal. No, nobody thinks that any of this is ideal. However, there's also 1,400 a year. So last year were moved out of HAP into social housing. I know there's a lot of figures there.
There are a lot of figures.
But the facts are important here.
Just specifically on that 160 HAP tenancies a week. Mm. Is that an increase? Are we likely to see a change then in the next quarterly report?
I think the change needs to be is the change in terms of social housing. Because I think that it's quite correct to say that people shouldn't be moving from private to private, that what they should be moving is from HAP into social housing. And that's where the provision of social housing is really important in this market. But we have to remember that there's all kinds of areas that it becomes really, really complex when you talk about reasons. That's why you need safety nets. But particularly, we need to drive up supply. That's what we've been doing.
Okay.
And as I say, numbers.
We'll get to some of that because I know Dara Brown did a press release on the affordable housing scheme and on new home starts and all of that sort of thing. But Jennifer, just to get your view on this, on what we've seen in this report, and really we've known that there's a crisis within the rental sector, but for those who especially rely, I mean, everyone relies on having a roof over their heads, but for those who will fall into homelessness if they simply don't have it, they're in a precarious situation right now, according to this report.
Oh, absolutely. And there's just so many people that are just really hanging on by a thread. I think the issue with HAP, obviously, is the privatisation of social housing, but it's also comes down to the fact that there just isn't enough affordable housing. And in, you know, in Wicklow, when people are coming into me and they're getting HAP, a lot of the times there's two people working, you know, and they're still in HAP houses or hoping to get HAP houses. So there is a whole issue of affordability. There's a whole issue of people being able to get that security. And there just really isn't any availability. Like, it's very, very difficult to access.
So what's the fix specifically around, you know, HAP properties, because we've heard from landlords that there are factors in this, the shortage of HAP, that there's an awful lot of red tape involved, that property owners say it's 6 to 8 weeks to get an application through. In that time, they're not getting rent where they could get rent if it's from somebody who's non-HAP. And there's also the exiting landlords, and that's an issue, and that's going to feed into the problem.
Yeah, and look, I mean, ultimately, we need more supply. We need more supply of social housing. We need more supply of affordable housing. The government's targets aren't sufficient. You know, the 33,000 of a target up to 2030, and, you know, the experts have said actually that should be 66,000. So the targets aren't even sufficient, and that's a major problem. So we need to get the supply up, and it needs to be affordable, and unfortunately we're not seeing affordability.
Craig, I mean, look, the affordability issue is a big one, and we do hear, and we heard from Pauline tonight, and we've heard from the minister earlier, it's all about building, but right now for people who are can't find properties, they can't actually find a place to live, this is of, you know, very cold comfort.
It is, and I guess it's unfortunate but unsurprising that people who require, you know, state assistance in this regard are the one who are feeling the constrained nature of the rental market the most. But when you go back to saying supply, that's all well and good in one sense, but it also needs to be the right housing type. So whatever about the targets going forward, if you even look at the last year's targets. So the state had a target of building for social homes 9,000, but they actually only delivered in 2022, 6,500. So while they're saying they're meeting their overall targets, that's what the private sector is delivering, when you look at what the state is delivering in terms of social, it actually isn't meeting what it pledged to do. That might shift a bit because this government, in fairness to them, did pivot the direction of the Land Development Agency to focus predominantly on social and affordable housing. So I think it's, you know, it would be unfair to say that they're ignoring the problem. They have made changes, but it's just slow to bear fruit.
All right. I want to bring Barry Rowntree in at this point. From your perspective, your view on this, do you believe that, I mean, what do we do about this issue around, you know, HAP? In many instances, people have to top up HAP payments in order to also find a property. So as a short-term fix, because we keep hearing about housing, houses being built and more social housing, but as a short-term fix, what needs to happen in your view?
Sure. So no one thinks that HAP is a good long-run solution, but it's kind of the price that we pay for having not fixed what is a more than a decade-long housing crisis. So HAP is there. There's a lot of families, tens of thousands, about almost 70,000 between HAP and the various schemes in receipt of that and rely on that. And many thousands more families would be homeless were it not for that payment. But the big problem is, as the Simon Community Report really, really shows, and as research that I did at the Economic and Social Research Institute shows, is that HAP isn't enough to cover what rents are. And it wasn't enough about 4 years ago. It wasn't, and it's been made less generous over time. And the reason for that is there's these limits on what you can get a property for. These limits were set in 2017. They haven't really been increased since. Local authorities have been given a little bit more discretion. But it's no surprise that there's decreasingly few properties available to rent under the HAP scheme when these rent limits aren't increased. So every year, you know, the state pension is increased, job seekers allowance is increased, tax credits are increased, but for some reason HAP rent limits aren't, they're frozen. And yet at the same time, what we see, and you know, the reason that's given by the government for this is they say, oh, well, we can't increase the rent limits because that will push up rents more generally, which I don't think has much credibility, particularly when you have the rent controls in place. But at the same time as that, they give 500 euro to each renter in the private sector on much higher levels of income, and they don't seem to have a concern around that. So in the short run, what can you do? You can make HAP cover more properties by increasing the rent limits. That's something which people have been continuously pointing to, and we haven't really seen happen.
Okay.
So that is one of the
All
things
right.
that you can help mitigate it
I
in
just,
the long run,
okay,
or in the short run, but then it is supply in the long run.
Okay. Pauline, just to get you on that, because the government have not increased those HAP rates, although I know that there is discretion within some councils, but you've made the decision not to do that. Why not?
Well, I mean, the as you say, there is a discretion. So that has been increased by the minister.
But the standard rate has not increased.
But I mean, you have to also take into consideration that you may have rent caps, but you also then have new homes coming on the market, which don't, you know, they can put their rent at any level. So I do think there has to be some controls. And look, I mean, I take on board what the minister is saying. I think he's doing it for the best of reasons, but I will go back to the fact that it is supply. And what I would like to pick up...
But I just want to pick up on something that Barra is saying there about...
And affordability I want to pick up on, if you don't
but
mind.
But just about the fact that there are sort of tax reliefs, there are, you know, that tax relief that came in for private renters that helped them, but there's not the equivalent for those on HAP who are having to top up, find it unaffordable and can't find properties.
I think there is, as I said earlier, there's... a list as long as your arm of different issues within the housing market that all have to be addressed. The minister has addressed it, and people can agree or disagree with the minister's approach. But I want to go back to the affordability issue because I do think it's really important. And I picked up particularly on what Jennifer had said around affordability and the importance of affordability. And I have a bit of a concern about, certainly anecdotally, about the fear that landlords have and landlords leaving the market. And I think that we're seeing that more and more anecdotally, landlords leaving the market. So that's why you really have to pivot in a different direction. That's why social housing is so important. Mm. That's why commencements are an all-time high. And we do have the Social Democrats who voted against the Affordable Housing Bill, who voted against the Land Development Agency, now saying that we need affordability. So I think that people are concerned about what's coming down the tracks. I also heard the Social Democrats last night saying they want 100% stamp duty for investors in the private market. We need both. We need the Land Development Agency. We need investors.
I'd like to let Jennifer respond to this.
In relation to the Vulture funds, what we need is we need houses and we need houses and we need apartments that people are able to buy, that people can buy and make homes for themselves.
We need people to build homes. What we do not need is
international investors coming in here, buying up large swathes of housing, controlling the market, setting rates so high or rents so high that they're actually defining what happens in that market, which is what we are seeing. And so having a 10%...
And
let's face it, the minister agreed that government was going to relook at this because they recognised that the 10%... Let me talk...
Shifting from 10
Pauline,
to 100%.
Pauline, let me talk... The 10% is not working. The minister said he would look at it. If you want something to work, you make it work. You don't put a measly 10%.
Well, I'd love to hear what you have to say about the affordable housing bill. I'd love to hear what you have to say about the Land Development Agency.
Plenty of opportunity to talk. But I do want to... If you put a tax...
You actually have
to have...
It
needs to be meaningful. It needs to be meaningful, Pauline. Putting a 10% tax on... an international vulture fund, they would be laughing at you. They are making incredible profits. 10% is nothing to them. So actually, make something meaningful.
Can I just ask, it was similar with the vacant tax
that they had on 0.3% vacant tax they had on properties. There is absolutely no point in putting something like that on that is actually not going to have any practical outcomes from it. All it is a veneer of trying to do something. People here have had enough of government and their shallow solutions to things that aren't actually achieving what they should achieve.
Like the Affordable Housing Act.
We have more people homeless than ever before.
Thanks,
Jennifer. More people living at home than ever before. So these solutions are not working of yours,
Pauline. Just on that issue around the stamp duty, because I know we're getting a little off topic now, but... you seem steadfast that the 10% is fine and that should not change. That's what the Greens in government will be saying.
It has had a shift, and it's not just that, but it's about the planning. And we've had individual cases where people have got their planning before this was put in place, and that's where you've seen some of these large investors come in. But overall, it is bringing things in the right direction. But we do need private investment. We do need Land Development Agency, and we need cost rental, which the Greens were the ones who put forward. And it is having a revolution impact. And again, you know, I think it's really important to also hold opposition to account for the solutions that are required.
I think you're asking those questions tonight. I just want to briefly just get back to Barra, if you're still with us, about this argument about raising the HAP rates, that if you raise a payment, it raises the rental floor. So properties that may have been in affordable areas where, you know, where there are more HAP more HAP properties, they'll now receive more money. So as a result, overall rents in that area get higher. What would you say to that? That it's not the solution in that it makes rents everywhere higher.
Yeah, no, there's not evidence that that's really happening. What we and I think that's particularly the case where, again, you have rent pressure zones in place, right? So landlords can only increase rents by a certain amount tied to now inflation, and the lower amounts there with the 2% cap. So I don't think that's going to be true. And I don't think that the size of the HAP sector is enough to be doing that. And again, if that is what you think, and if you are concerned about that, then why would you go ahead and put in a €500 rent credit for every private renter that there is? And again, a group who are perhaps struggling, but there are much higher incomes than those who are in receipt of HAP. So I don't think you can have it both ways, which is what we kind of hear from the government in relation to this. And again, just on those HAP rent limits, like, there's a discretion available for local authorities, but even with, as the Simon Community report shows, even with that discretion at the maximum, you are not finding places for people to be able to rent through HAP. And so as a result, they pay top-up payments, which make their rent really unaffordable. And that is something to be concerned about. It's something that could be addressed, but it is a question of prioritisation.
OK, Wayne, on that, I'm sure you're agreeing with what Barra has to say about that as a
I think the last point is a particularly important one. Pauline talked about 160 HAP. New HAP tenancies are being created. That's true. But as Barra is saying, that's because people are topping up by €200, €300, €400, €500 a month. So what we're seeing is the reason why the rates haven't gone up is because the burden of the cost is being put on the people who can least afford it. And the state is benefiting and seen to be prudent in its fiscally, but actually what it's doing is putting the cost of this on the shoulders of people who can least afford it and putting them at risk of homelessness. They need to increase the HAP rates. Full agreement, the state cannot continue to chase an unaffordable private rental market. But what it can do, the answer to that is to build more social housing. But when you're not building enough and you're not allocating enough, you're going to see increases in homelessness and you're going to see more and more pressure put on people who are vulnerable. So the answer is to do both.
Briefly, Craig, the bottom line, I suppose, with all of this is the government is promising that, you know, to try and end the homeless problem, build more houses than ever. When you have reports like this coming out, it just simply doesn't look good. It doesn't look like, you know, that there is that level of progress that's needed to help those who are at the very vulnerable end of things.
It doesn't, but I guess what they'll point to is the significant enough level of increase in overall output since their tenure in government. I mean, last year they reached 33,000 overall when the target was 29,000. Now, as Jennifer's rightly said, those targets we know are too low, and based on 2016 census data, they're going to be revised upwards to somewhere between 50 and 60,000. The real, I guess what you probably need to see is a real focus on residential development. So, I mean, you had the Taoiseach talking about potentially 40,000 next year, while the Construction Federation of Ireland said they could probably do 60 if they were directed properly. So that's taking the focus off corporate office developments and other perhaps capital projects and really focusing on residential.
Next week, we're going to get the 2023 housing completion data in full. Is that likely to be good news from Dara O'Brien's department?
Yes, so actually the Taoiseach got better into the punch on the good news on Friday at a Fine Gael, on Monday at a Fine Gael event, where he said it looks like they built 33,000 homes last year. So that's ahead of target. But what'll be interesting to see is the breakdown of that, of how many new social homes are built within that overall cohort.
All right, and that is where the opposition are sticking them on that one, on the issue around social and affordable homes. My thanks to Wayne Stanley and to Barra Rowe.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
country. Coming up next, we debate if extended opening times for pubs will impact our roads. Do stay with us. Welcome back. A government bill proposing to increase trading hours for bars and restaurants from 11:30pm to 12:30am while extending last orders in nightclubs to 5am venues will be allowed to stay open till 6am. Well, some have argued that this will have a detrimental impact on our roads, leading to an increase in drink driving. Pauline O'Reilly, Green Party Senator, Jennifer Whitmore, Social Democrat TD, and Craig Hughes, political correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail, have stayed on with us. We are also joined by Dr. Sheila Gilheeny, the CEO of Alcohol Action Ireland, because Sheila, this is your report that you've brought out, that you're very concerned that this increase in trading hours will lead to a direct correlation with an increase in drink driving and fatalities on our roads. Where's the evidence around that?
Well, actually, there's a lot of evidence from right across the world, but we've been drawing attention particularly to a recent report that came out from Norway, which really looked at this in depth. And one of the things that they found is that there is this relationship between increased drink driving, but especially increased collisions, especially in rural areas. In fact, they saw that in those rural areas, they could see increases of up to 30% by just extending licensing hours by 1 hour. So we know here in Ireland, we have seen the horrific increase we've already had, you know, over this last year. 37% of road fatalities, the driver would have a positive toxicology for alcohol. But actually, over 70% of those deaths are occurring in rural roads. So we're saying, you know, there's really something that we need to be looking at here. If we're going to increase licensing hours, we really need to be taking these sorts of things into account. And what we're calling for is for the Minister for Justice to do a health impact assessment of all of the proposals and cost this out, really look and see, you know, we need to be increasing, you know, Garda resources who would be in those areas. But you'd also have to be increasing Garda resources to deal with, you know, street disorder and stuff like that. So that has to be taken into account.
So you're particularly concerned with the consequences in rural parts of the country.
Yes, we
and that's where your focus is there. So would you look to perhaps, you know, allowing or, you know, advocating, pending a health assessment report, you know, later opening hours, say in urban areas, but for rural areas, for them to look at the consequences of not having the transport infrastructure and the increased risk?
Yeah, we would say this bill has to be looked at in the round, and there are consequences, whether we're talking in cities or whether we're talking in rural areas. We're specifically here talking about road deaths, but in city areas we can also see there's increased, you know, problems likely to occur from street disorder. You know, so...
Okay,
we
so there are a number of other factors, and you have been opposed to this all along. We know that. Pauline, I suppose there's the logic. The pubs stay open later, the chance of people getting into their cars increase accordingly. Whether it's a good move for business or not, would you accept that there are risk factors, increased risk factors, with keeping premises open later?
I think, you know, like, we absolutely have to take every measure to stop any accident on the road, and that includes from alcohol consumption and getting behind the wheel when you're drinking. But whether you take a drink at 4 in the afternoon or you take a drink at 2 in the morning and then get behind a wheel, it's still illegal and it's still wrong. So like, just to put that out there. And I think that it would be a mistake to say that what happens in another country is automatically going to happen here. The legislation does put in more enforcement powers for the Gardaí. There's been massive, like, extensive consultation, 5,000 submissions. So it is being looked at in the round. And it's not just about business, but business is important. I mean, I'm in Galway and I see, like, there's hardly any nightclubs to go to anymore, but it's not just business. It's about the overall well-being of our people. Cultural events, arts events, and being sociable is really important.
I just want to pull back.
And there's
back.
A real danger. Sorry, Claire.
Yeah, and I know that all the benefits, and we'll hear a little bit more on that as people view it from, you know, changing the law on this, and there's been a big lobby around that. But looking at that Norwegian study showing that, you know, increased trading hours were associated with a decline in drink driving in urban areas, but an actual increase in rural areas. Like, has it been considered as a risk factor, given that we don't necessarily have the taxis there, the public transport to take that if you have, you know, extended trading hours.
Well, I think all of that...
That this does pose a risk.
All of that has to be taken into consideration. But the enforcement is regardless of whether it's rural or urban. And my experience is from the Gardaí in certain areas, including in rural areas, and, you know, I'm in both an urban and a rural constituency, is that what Gardaí don't want is everybody piling out at the exact same time and searching around for some way to get home. And, you know, that's what creates a huge danger. And it's not just a danger, which is massive. We need to consider road deaths, but it's also women's safety. It's all of the things that we put people at risk at. And actually, a survey within Dublin found that 32% of people said they don't want to go out in the evening because they're worried about getting transport home. And it's because everybody's coming out at the exact same time. Everybody's trying to get transport. So we need to make sure that there are night buses.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. Then taxis. Then the infrastructure has to be in place, doesn't it?
It does have to be all in place. And there are now, there's a massive investment gone in on pilot schemes to see how this would work. There's also a massive investment gone in that there are nighttime economy staff within the councils to look at how it actually works in reality. But we have to invest in other things that not just about drink.
Yeah.
You know, so let's just say that.
Jennifer, would you agree or do you share any of Sheila's concerns about what may happen with the increase in trading hours and the perceived associated risks with that?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be interested in seeing the Norwegian study. I lived in Norway for a short time, many, many years ago, and the drinking culture there was very different to here. You know, we used to have to get wine through our bank, you know, things like this. So it was a very different way of operating over then. I don't know how easily it is sort of transcribed to the Irish situation.
But it does point to, I suppose, in rural areas where there's a lack of public transport, people as a result are more likely to get in their cars. So the risk factor increases in rural areas. Is that something you're concerned about, that the party would be concerned about with the change in the trading hours?
Well, I think it comes down to making sure that we have enough public transport available, that there's enough taxis. And you know, I take Pauline's point, like when everyone's trying to get home at 12 o'clock or half 12 at night, it's very, there's a huge demand. Whereas if it's a bit of a spread, well, then I think that would ease. And then also in relation to, like, you know, antisocial behaviour, again, that's, you know, when everyone's coming out and, you know, if they're sort of downing a few pints before the bell goes and they're all put out on the street, like that in itself is a really, really bad way of dealing with things. So actually maybe spreading it out across the night is a much better way of dealing with it.
All right, the problem with all this, Craig, is that we don't have the full, which I think Sheila has called for, this health impact assessment report, or, you know, to look at really what the potential consequences of all of it are. As someone who has skin in the game, as in your festival, you're more than a festival promoter, you're a festival founder, day and night festival that runs during the summer, I take it you'd very, and in a rural part of the country, but you would very much be in favour of saying, drink all night and, you know, make your way home but try to do so safely. But, you know, it's that freedom is important.
No, I think it is very important. So, like, we run the Night and Day Festival in Lochy Forest Park, in Boyle and Roscommon. And I guess the first thing to look at is the actual licensing laws themselves, right? They need to change. So at the moment, whether you're a normal bar that wants a late bar license or an event, you have to go and pay to have a late license every night you want to trade. That just isn't practical for the rest of the sector. When it comes to us running the festival, last year, for example, we had buses after the event. So most people will camp there. It's a three-day camping festival this year. We had buses going back to the main towns of Boyle and Carrick and Shannon. And this year, we're looking to put on an extra bus that goes to Sligo. So I think when you look at it in the round and say, OK, we're giving people extra trading time, the wraparound has to be there. So, for example, if it's in an urban area, the transport will probably be fine. But if you're going to be...
But will it be there? I mean, that's the question. It's OK, like, you can say, yeah, we have a festival and we'll lay on extra buses, so we'll... That makes sense for you, makes financial sense for you to keep people there longer and all the rest of it. But I'm talking about, you know, your rural pub, like, are they going to adapt according to the change in trading hours? And is there the footfall? And if everyone is not coming out at the same time, are you going to have people coming out in dribs and drabs and then taken to the car on their own?
But I think when you're talking about pubs, I mean, you're talking about an hour or two here or there. I think the big issue with the opening times that people are raising is with nightclubs, right? So if you're trading till 5 a.m. and being allowed to open till 6, they will have to go to the courts to apply for a nightclub licence. So it'll be up to the court to say, OK, have you met all the criteria set out in the guidelines by the minister to warrant getting a nightclub licence to stay open until 6 a.m.
Oh, right. OK, so then, therefore, I suppose the argument is, Sheila, that the, you know, you open premises later and the infrastructure will be in place because they won't be able to get the licence unless the system is working.
Yeah, so what the government is actually proposing right now is a shortened form of this bill, which is simply there to extend the licensing hours. There's nothing in it about, you know, doing anything about transport or anything like that. We really come back to this. Decisions are being made without the full facts. We don't have the facts of how much is it going to cost to have any extra transport, how much is it going to cost to police to have Gardaí on duty at, you know, later hours that are there. We don't have the facts about how much is going to cost EDs and ambulance services to pick up, to carry the burden of what's there. So
what about the argument that we've heard, and we heard it from Jennifer and from Pauline, that if you have people who are coming out, who are not coming out en masse, that's actually a safer environment?
So we can look to the evidence from England and Wales, which essentially has 24-hour licensing available. And what they found there is that the problems didn't go away. They were just shifted further into the night. And on Garda Síochána, in their own submission to the Oireachtas Justice Committee, who looked at this, you know, have expressed concerns on a number of different fronts. So they've expressed concerns that they will be, you know, basically working at full pitch throughout the whole night. There's no downtime at all. They expressed concerns about the risk to pedestrians in terms of, you know, more traffic collisions later on in the evening.
All right. Is that a good point? And we already know that the pressure that's on Gardaí to, you know, to patrol the streets as it is, that really that hasn't all been worked out yet. And yet, you know, government are very keen to push through these changes.
I think it's always fair to say how's this going to work? But I don't think that we can continue with a system that is very much outdated, doesn't fit with the lives of, in relation to young people, nightclubs. It just doesn't fit with people's lives. And so we're kind of shifting. Already there are problems shifting in other directions towards drugs. You know,
but
there's all kinds of
issues. But in a very practical way, don't we need to ensure then that there are Gardaí? I mean, the thing is that people say, you know, during the day and the evening, like before you get to 2, 3, 4, 5 in the morning, like you don't have the Gardaí around. How are you going to ensure that they will be there if you're extending all these opening hours?
I absolutely agree with that point. Like, I'm not disputing that point, but I think it's really important to say that the bill also includes much stricter kind of laws around you have to have CCTV, that the Gardaí, that makes the Gardaí's jobs an awful lot easier, that the guards can go to the district court to get an emergency closure order, which at the moment they can't do. So it allows the Gardaí to have a lot more control, but we can't continue to have a system that we have like a nationally enforced bedtime. You know, that's not working. And that's, we have alcohol problems in the country, but we have an enforced bedtime. So obviously the current system's not working. We have to shift, take on board everybody's concerns and say, how do we actually make the guards' jobs easier? But also say, it's important to have a social life. It's important to have the arts. It's important to have culture.
I think it's very important that we actually have facts when we're dealing with this. I mean, we talked there about that 5,000 people or, you know, submissions were made, but these were views as opposed to actual, what's the cost of what is going to be here in Ireland to do this?
But on the premise that if there's a big push and that everyone is, you know, bar, say, Alcohol Action Ireland and
I really would like actually to say this, because we have three speakers here who, you know, maybe are just perhaps not, you know, reflecting widespread public support about this. So I'll just say, for example, we have concerns been raised by the likes of the Irish Medical Association organisation, concerns from psychiatrists of the College of Psychiatrists in Ireland, ourselves, obviously, but many other groups. We have certainly seen people who are involved in women's aid, or sorry, not women's aid, but in relation to domestic violence.
I think it is important to clarify that.
And I will also say that, you know, like in polling data that we have seen about this, the 60% of women are concerned about, you know, violence that will arise from this. So it's much, much more than just ourselves.
I think Sheila is right. You know, maybe this isn't reflecting the concerns that will be out there, Craig, about the impact of all of this, you know, around
young people's drinking habits, concerns of pressures on a health service and all of that, that they say, look, at the moment, our system is struggling to cope with the impact of, you know, excessive drinking. What's going to happen now?
Well, I think you also have to look at the impact on the entertainment industry. And for example, if you go back 20 years, there was around 500 nightclubs in Ireland. It's down now down to around 80. I mean, because the sector simply hasn't been able to survive in the conditions that have been created. And I think as well, with the wider reform of these laws, it'll actually open up other cultural spaces to have events where, yes, you might be able to have alcohol at it as well. But I think generally, as a country, we seem to be becoming much more progressive in our attitudes towards alcohol consumption.
So the law will mean it doesn't have to be just an alcohol serving premises. It can be anywhere that stays open till, you know, 3, 4, 5 a.m. and maybe people want to go out and not drink.
Yeah, because if you wanted to go...
And enjoy an all-nighter safely.
Yeah.
All right, OK, that's your sell. But can you see, just briefly, Jennifer, on that, for what Sheila had to say, that these other... And we're not represented tonight by those within the health service who are saying we're struggling as it is and it's going to put a dreadful strain on us, that this health impact report is something that should be carried out before we see any changes to the laws.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's important when you're, you know, making legislation that you do listen to the evidence and, you know, I imagine the Rockets Committee and, you know, has considered that. But I think what's also, I understand where Sheila's come from, but I think there's sort of other issues here when you're talking about, say, road traffic, you know, collisions, things like that, and we need enforcement. We've seen a reduction in the road traffic Gardaí. Like, there's 47 less this year, at the end of last year, than there was at the start. So I think, you know, there's other factors that are playing into it as well, and it comes down to making sure that, you know, that the other services are there. But, like, you know, as I said, I've lived in areas where we've had longer licensing, and I don't get the sense from being in those countries that people are going out and staying and getting drunker. I think it's sort of, people tend to go out later, they may stay out longer, but it's not as, I suppose, intense, I think, as sometimes you get in Ireland.
I think if I could just actually, let's look north of the border. Licensing hours were increased there in October 2021. They have seen an increase of 17% in alcohol-related crime. So we don't have to look too far to actually see the evidence. We need to have a measurement of what that would mean here in Ireland.
We will have to leave that there for now. My thanks to Pauline, to Jennifer and to Sheila. Coming up after the break, the strike that has ground Northern Ireland to a halt. Do stay with us. Welcome back. Nurses, teachers, train drivers and more took to the picket lines as an estimated 170,000 public sector workers went on strike in Northern Ireland today. According to the Irish Congress for Trade Unions, many of these workers have not had a pay increase for 3 years despite the cost of living crisis. We'll hear it more on this is Belfast-based journalist Amanda Ferguson. A huge show of strength on the streets today, Amanda. Give us some background on the root cause of this action.
Well, there's a lot of desperate people out there, and that was reflected today whenever I was visiting the picket lines. We know that we haven't had a fully functioning government in the north for nearly 2 years now. And just before Christmas, the Secretary of State put a £3.3 billion package on the table for politicians. But the Treasury in London is linking that money, which includes £600 million for public sector pay, with the restoration of Stormont. So the UK government won't make that money available unless the politicians go back. And we know from the Stormont recall that we had yesterday, the seventh recall since the Assembly election in May 2022, when Sinn Féin emerged as the largest party, that there's been so many attempts to try and get Stormont back up and running, and they haven't succeeded. And the workers and the union reps that I was speaking to today essentially feel as if they're being used as political pawns or political footballs in some sort of toxic game between the UK government and the DUP. So that's where we find ourselves now. And some of the stories that I heard today, Claire, were really, really harrowing. One bus driver told me that one of the members had said to her that They had started to play a game with their children called Picnic in Bed Day and made it out to be a game to the children, but it was essentially because they couldn't afford to heat their home and they were having to do that. And I was talking to teachers who can't afford childcare, a whole range of different people who are really at the end of their tether.
Yeah, are workers in the UK paid more than in Northern Ireland when it comes to public sector wages? How do they compare to those in the UK?
Yeah, the Northern Ireland public sector workers are the poorest paid in the UK. So when I was talking to a nursing manager outside the Mater Hospital in North Belfast today, she was saying that they want pay parity, that they don't want to be second class citizens, that they don't want to be devalued. And even teachers that I was talking to were saying that, young trainee teachers are moving on elsewhere, are going to other jurisdictions, are going to other countries because they're getting paid thousands of pounds more than they would if they stayed within Northern Ireland. So it really is a really grim picture at the moment. There's a lot of people who feel quite hopeless and helpless because there really isn't anything that they can do apart from this continued industrial action. And we know that the trade unions are meeting again in the morning to decide what their next steps are going to be, and that's likely to be escalation. And in the meantime, road service workers are continuing with strike action, which means the roads aren't going to be gridded in the coming days, apart from four of the main thoroughfares. So that's going to have some knock-on effects and issues. And we know that the Education Authority workers have other dates in the diary as well for further strike action. So it's a pretty messy picture, but the Secretary of State for the UK government, Chris Heaton-Harris, is due to make a statement on Monday about extending the deadline for a fresh Assembly election. And also there may be other considerations that we just don't know about yet.
All right. Amanda, thank you for joining us on that. Craig, to come to you on all of this piling huge political pressure to get power sharing back on the North. I mean, is this sort of pressure going to prompt the DUP to do anything, put more pressure on the UK government to, apply the pressure on the DUP and get the structures back up and running again?
Well, look, it's a pretty high stakes game of political poker that's going on here between Chris Heaton-Harris and the politicians, particularly the DUP in the North. But I think when you see scenes like today, it becomes a very difficult wicket for the DUP to defend not going back into Stormont.
All right, OK. But you'd have to say, you'd wonder how it play out. I guess the longer it goes on, the greater the pressure grows with all of that. I'd like to thank Amanda Ferguson, who joined us down the line, also to Craig, who's been with us, and all our panellists tonight. That is all from us, from all the late team here. Good night and do take care.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.